Blog Talk Radio.
You're now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. A voice out of nowhere delves deep into the mind of a psychotic killer. In this tragic true story about one young man's harrowing descent into madness and murder, a voice out of nowhere offers a rare glimpse inside the workings of a criminally disordered mind. In a narrative style of nonfiction novels like In Cold Blood and Columbine, best-selling author Janice Holly Booth draws from court transcripts, eyewitness statements, and personal interviews to go beyond the headlines and share little-known details of the tragedy. Fascinating, riveting, and heartbreaking, A Voice Out of Nowhere will incite readers to think differently about the insanity defense and the awful consequences of untreated mental illness. The book that we're featuring this evening is A Voice Out of Nowhere, Inside the Mind of a Mass Murderer, with my special guest, journalist and author Janice Holly Booth. Welcome to the program, and thank you for agreeing to this interview, Janice Holly Booth.
Thank you, Dan. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you very much. Very interesting book, and let's get right to this. This crime and the trial and everything that we really talk about in this book, for the most part, happened in the 80s, after 1983. Tell us why you felt it important to put this book out at this time. What made you or what compelled you to put out this book at this time?
Well, Dan, I was actually a court recorder at the time that the Voice Out of Nowhere case came into the courtroom, and I was really fascinated by how untreated mental illness can drive people to do really the unthinkable. And I'd always thought I would tell the story, but it just never seemed like the right time. And then, the last 20 years in the United States, we've had just growing numbers of murders committed by people who were found to be mentally ill. And I decided when Sandy Hook happened that it was probably time to tell this story. When the Aurora movie theater shooting happened, I knew it was time to tell the story, to help people gain an insight into the mind of someone who is driven to do the unthinkable because of the mental illness that they suffer from.
Now, you say you were a court recorder, and so you're involved in the criminal justice system, but you were also interested in mental illness and schizophrenia and psychology. And in the beginning of the book, you talk about what inspired you to, again, gave you this interest in psychology, an interest unlike most people's interests. So tell us about these incidents that shaped your life and direction in your life.
Well, when I was in my early 20s, I was working in the court system. I was also studying creative writing at college at night, and I had a woman in my class who was a very good writer. And she kind of disappeared from class. We never really knew what happened to her. And then one day I found myself in court, and she was brought in because, and she'd been arrested because she tried to commit suicide by jumping off a bridge. And she was the woman who had disappeared from my writing class. And so she didn't recognize me, but I was, obviously very interested in what had happened to her, what was going to happen to her. And I followed her case. It turned out that she was, she'd been diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. She was not staying on her medications. She'd had a baby, and the baby had been taken away from her. And I watched her descent, and it was absolutely harrowing to see this former friend of mine be literally railroaded into failure by the system. And she was institutionalized at a mental institution known as Riverview, and she committed suicide while under suicide watch there. And I was completely outraged by that, that the system that was supposedly trying to keep her safe had failed her on such an epic level. 2 years later, another one of my fellow writing students was murdered. He himself was a person with paranoid schizophrenia and was trying to make a life for himself. His roommate was also a diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic, but he had gone off his medication and killed my friend. And in that case, my friend's death barely even made the headlines. And so I just became fascinated by this mental illness known as schizophrenia and really wanted to know, you know, what might it be like to have to live under its spell? What goes on in the mind of someone who is possessed by that mental illness? And thus began really a lifelong fascination with the disease and a dedication to studying it and telling the stories.
Now, to give it a little aside as well, this crime, this incredible mass murder happened in the 80s, 83, and you moved to the United States, North Carolina, South Carolina, in 85. It's not really, I'm just curious myself, why did you move at that time? And we'll be able to talk about some of the study that you've done since you've been a U.S. resident and the differences from Canada and the U.S., and that'll be important to this story, I think, as well.
Well, I actually moved not from British Columbia to North Carolina, which would kind of make sense, but I moved from British Columbia to Buffalo, New York. And I lived there for 13 years. I like to say I did a hard time in Buffalo for 13 years, but only because of the snow. You know, the people were wonderful. The food was great. But I actually moved because of marriage. And when that didn't work out, I stayed in New York for a while and then had an opportunity to move to where it's sunny all the time in North Carolina, and I've been here now for about 16 years.
Now, getting back to this incredible case and incident, tell our audience, for those that don't know, in proximity to a city that even an international audience would know, Vancouver, British Columbia, on the west coast of Canada, and we're talking about Coquitlam, British Columbia. So just describe what this community is. Is it a suburb? Is it a community outside of Vancouver? What's it really like? Tell us how big it is, and then we can see that the impact of two people that you know going to this one little hospital or from the same hospital and, like you say, meeting their deaths,
right.
both people, you know.
Right, right. Well, of course, Vancouver is a huge and beautiful city. Coquitlam is probably a 30-minute drive from there. And in 1983, it wasn't overly developed. It's quite a bustling place now, but it was a quiet, kind of sleepy neighborhood. Actually, the murders occurred only 8 miles from where I was living. And, you know, just really nothing much of any national import happened in these what they called bedroom communities. So when this particular mass murder occurred, it caught the nation's attention in such a big way for lots of different reasons. It was considered at the time one of Canada's worst mass murders, but it was committed by a young man who had absolutely no history of violence. And yet the crime was gruesome, horrific, and inexplicable. So, it had those qualities of capturing national attention right away, not only for its, you know, the hugeness of it, but also because it literally came out of nowhere.
Now, tell us the background of the perpetrator, the killer in this case, and the family, the available information that you had on. Give us the background on this young man, because you said this man was very similar in age, a year apart, you and he, and tell us as much as you can about the family itself.
Sure. The young man was 22 years old. I was 23, which seems impossible right now, Dan.
Right.
I just can't imagine that, but he was a young man who was from a fairly large family, a very loving family, a family with no drama. I mean, you know, parents were good people. They worked hard to provide for their kids. No mental illness in the family history. They did move around a lot. The young man, his name is Bruce, who committed the murders. He had some issues growing up. You know, he was a little bit dyslexic. He was an identical twin, but he was diagnosed early on as being, quote, a mirror twin, which I know there are people in the audience gasping now because that's not really a legitimate diagnosis for anything. But back then, it was. And I think it kind of set in his mind this idea that he was always going to be opposite. You know, opposite, everything that happened to him was opposite what would happen to his brother. His brother had good grades. Bruce had horrible grades. His brother was very organized and neat. Bruce was very disorganized and kind of disheveled. And this diagnosis of being a mirror, I think, set into Bruce's mind the idea of opposites, which would play a huge role in the ideology that he created, his mind created, the delusions created around the circumstances of the murders. But he was, you know, up until the time that he started exhibiting signs of mental illness, he was very likable. He was a, you know, really friendly, very happy-go-lucky, easygoing young man who had a lot of friends and really just didn't have any skeletons in the closet. I should also mention, because this is something that's going on in our society right now that we need to be paying attention to, that he was a heavy, heavy user of marijuana and had been since grade 7, or 7th grade, as we say in the U.S. And doctors did agree later on that probably contributed to the severity of his psychosis.
I wanted to ask, where did he get the concept, again, for, and please explain this a little bit more, and I guess maybe with this question you will be able to, the concept of this mirror twin, where did this come from, and when was Bruce and his family, tell us about this incident where this concept is accepted by Bruce, but more importantly, who is the person that explained this concept?
Okay. Well, his mother, Irene, was very worried that Bruce was not doing well in school, even though he was trying very, very hard. And they were putting a lot of pressure on him to do better because, you know, his twin brother was doing just fine. And when improvement wasn't forthcoming, Irene decided to take Bruce to see a specialist. And she did, and he took the standard tests, you know, to check for dyslexia and certain other things. And while he was in the doctor's office, this doctor, I think he was a psychologist, made the pronouncement that Bruce was a mirror twin, and we do have evidence that it really shocked both of them. It shocked the mother, and it shocked Bruce. And Bruce said later on, in interviews with the psychiatrist, that that, you know, that's kind of when the idea stuck in his mind that whatever he saw in the world going forward, he needed to perceive it as an opposite. So black would be white, man would be woman, right would be wrong. I mean, I'm being very sort of general, but
wow.
That suggestion that the doctor made, I think, was one of the seeds that grew when his mental illness took hold.
Yeah, it seems like a ridiculous diagnosis, all things considered, regardless. I was unaware of this diagnosis. It sounds like something out of a B-movie. Anyway, must be Canada. We'll get back to that. We'll get to that point a little bit later. Anyway, so at this time, he was not on any medication after this first meeting with the psychologist. How did his mental health and did he frequent this doctor quite often, and how did his mental health progress from that point?
Well, he actually was not showing any signs of mental illness at this point because he was maybe, you know, I'm just pulling from my memory now, but maybe, you know, very, very early teens, maybe he was 12.
Okay.
But we don't really know. You know, nobody can really say for sure when symptoms of schizophrenia begin to take hold. And maybe, you know, it was very mild at that point because he did sort of become fixated on the idea of opposites. But the signs of mental illness really manifested in him in 1982, around October. And he started to hear voices, particularly coming from the television, and the voices were telling him that the world was going to end and that he, Bruce, had some part in that. Then he began to hear a particular voice from what he called the white woman with eyes of fire, and she told him that he was alternatively God, the devil, the Antichrist, Jehovah, and that he was about to become Time, with a capital T. And so he had all of these very confusing messages coming at him. And he was actually saying to people, I think I'm possessed. I'm hearing voices. I don't know what's happening to me. He was certainly telling his parents. He was telling his friends. But his parents were aware that he was a heavy marijuana smoker, and they initially thought, you know, it was just due to that. So they really didn't take him very seriously. But then it got to the point where he couldn't sleep. He couldn't eat. He was shaking all the time. He was just fixated on this idea that the world was going to end, and got the idea that the answer, which was written specifically for him, was in the book of Revelation. So he began to read that religiously, no pun intended. He began to read it to the exclusion of everything else, and began to form what is really a very fascinating thread of reality out of unreality in his mind. And that's what ultimately drove him to commit the mass murder.
Now let's go backwards just a bit. You talked about the chronic marijuana use, and again, we'll discuss this a little bit later because I have heard this research that at least it can be connected to schizophrenia, but at the same time, marijuana use at an early age, schizophrenia onset is typically at this early age. I don't know if that's, you know, I think that's a point of contention in terms of the drug or which came first, the chicken or the egg. But certainly it can contribute to the overall symptoms of out of touch with reality. Now, let's get back, though, to what was his situation in terms of he had this loving family, they were, you know, pretty normal family, had this chronic marijuana use, but he also was living with was he living with a roommate, and was there the idea that he wasn't sleeping, which again is very, very consistent with what schizophrenia's schizophrenics exhibit in terms of behavior, not sleeping, not eating. Tell us about what you wrote in the book about in terms of his situation, his living situation, his lifestyle at that time.
Well, he had had a number of jobs that he wasn't able to keep. He worked as a roofer, he worked as a car mechanic, and he was actually a very good mechanic, but he wasn't able to hold down these jobs. And then he got a job as a swamper on a garbage truck, and basically the guy who hangs off the back of the garbage truck and jumps down and, you know, empties the garbage into the truck. And he really,
sure,
he liked that job, you know. With his dyslexia and everything, he didn't have to fill out reports, he didn't have to read manuals. It was, he could go to work, he could do his job, and so that was a good situation for him. He was living in Lonsdale, on Lonsdale Avenue in North Vancouver, which is near Grouse Mountain, for those of our listeners who have ever been out there and skied. And he had a roommate who was also a heavy marijuana user. And the roommate was the first person to really notice the signs. And when he gave evidence in court, he said that that Bruce was constantly saying, you know, the world's going to end. Look, the television. Look at the television. And then Bruce would sit there and stare at it. And it was an episode of All in the Family. And, you know, there would be a laugh track going. There'd be a really funny scene, and Bruce would say, oh, my, you know, there it is. Look, the world is going to end. But his roommate, for whatever reason, just dismissed it, didn't tell his parents, didn't reach out, didn't say to Bruce, you know, I think you might need help. And then there was this incident. As this whole thing was escalating, there was an incident when his roommate came home with a friend, and there were five coffee mugs set out on the table. And Bruce told them that the three of them and two of their other friends had to be there that night because the world was going to end and they all had to be together. So the two friends said, you're crazy, ha ha ha, and they left. Well, Bruce was so convinced that the world was going to end and that they all had to be together, and it was his job to make sure that they were, that he ran over to the friend's house, where they all were, and just, you know, was just begging and pleading with them that we all have to be together at 8 o'clock. The world's going to end, and you know, they put him off and mocked him. He got really angry, and as he was leaving, he opened the door, and he fell to his knees and started weeping because he said he saw the beast. And what was there was the neighbor's dog, you know, wagging its tail. But what Bruce saw was this hideous monster with fangs dripping blood, and he thought that the beast had come to end the world. And so that's when things really started going haywire. But nobody got him any help. And so Bruce was experiencing these kinds of episodes, these delusions and hallucinations on a fairly regular basis with no one who would believe him or help him. By the time it got to be, you know, really critical, he was really, I mean, you know, fully psychotic. I mean, he was not connected to reality at all. But he hadn't tipped over, you know, he hadn't gotten violent. But that's only because he hadn't, in his mind, figured out what all of these messages were. And it would take that. It would take the weaving together of all of these messages and creating, in his mind, a plausible story before he would commit the murders.
Now, a little bit more of his background. Was his family at all religious, and does the Jehovah's Witness pamphlets have anything to do with this story?
His family was not, they were not religious. There was no, absolutely no evidence presented in court that the family went to church or practiced any kind of religion. But when Bruce was living in his apartment on Lonsdale Avenue in North Vancouver, Jehovah's Witnesses would leave pamphlets. And so as he was entering this early stage where ideas were kind of being planted in his mind, he would read those pamphlets called Awake, and I can't remember the other one, but...
Watchtower.
Thank you. Yes, Watchtower. And in these pamphlets, typically, what he would zero in on was the message that the end of the world was coming, and when the end of the world came, that only a few people would ascend to heaven. And, of course, he wanted to be one of those. So that's why he began this this fervent focus on the Book of Revelation, which, of course, details the end, you know, the end of the world, the end of time, and trying, really, to find some clue, some direction as to what he was supposed to do to save himself, and eventually, by trying to figure out how to save himself, he realized he had been the one chosen to save the world, and that involved his family.
Now, how many, you talk about in the book how many days this is, this spiral, as you call it. So we're talking about, we're not talking about a really long time to make sure that the audience knows what we're talking about. So tell us how many days this descent is, this spiral into this obvious murderous rampage, and tell us that he does have no contact with his family. I mean, this friend seems to be clueless, or at least he sees the symptoms but doesn't recognize it. How can we tell us how many days this is, and how on earth anybody could avoid, you know, family and friends seeing this obvious descent and doing something about it?
Well, his trajectory was steep, frighteningly so. And I really hope that any listeners out there who have family members who might be exhibiting some signs really take this to heart. Because Bruce himself identifies the very day that he went over the edge, and that was December 3rd. And I can talk about what happened on that day if you want. But
sure.
From the day that he himself knew that he was a goner to the time he committed mass murder was 46 days.
Well, tell us about that from that December 3rd. Tell us about that. How the logic that he conjured up in his mind to be able to do this.
Okay, and I'm gonna add something too at the end of it. But he was, you know, he was already reading the Book of Revelation. He'd already had this white woman with eyes of fire speaking to him. He'd heard in his mind the devil, and he sits down on December 3rd to watch television, and The Magic Christian, starring Peter Sellers and Ringo Starr, comes on. And he starts watching it. And every single delusion that he has had, every single voice that he has heard, is manifested in that show. And he said to his psychiatrist, "That is the day I became possessed. I was no longer me." And I'm going to tell you something, Dan. I watched part of The Magic Christian, and everything he said is true. There is a white woman in there with eyes of fire. There is the devil. There are worlds colliding. I mean, it put chills down my spine when I watched that. And the scary thing is that show didn't put those ideas into his head. He already had them. That show just underscored them, you know, drove the nail into the coffin.
Yeah, it seemed to reinforce the ideas, and so, but it's typical as well that they would look for something like that to be communicating with, be in sync with, for this manifestation of the same type mindset. Anyway, go ahead.
Absolutely, absolutely. But what's so weird about this whole case, and I say this in retrospect, is there were so many bizarre coincidences like that. You know, to have, it wasn't just a couple of things in that movie. It was everything in that movie. And I'm sure we'll talk about this later on, but there was some, you know, he was interested in numerology too, and he figured out that birth dates and birth weights and birth times and everything meant something in terms of the hallucinations that he was having. And even the psychiatrist in court said, you know, it's a very odd coincidence that X, Y, and Z happened and that he was right about that. He also seemed to have a little bit of an ability to kind of predict what was going to happen. It's very strange. You know, this isn't the typical, you know, you just sort of fall off the cliff and get lost. I mean, there were just so many very, very unusual coincidences.
Now, in his mind, how does, through revelations, what does he hone in on in particular in terms of passages, and what does he sort of create in terms of this, save the world? What does he is commanded to do, or what does he believe he needs to do?
Well, a lot, you know, and depending on which voice was talking to him at the time, you know, he would pull a different meaning. But basically, he was looking at the end of the world. He was looking at what would be the end of the world. It would be the Big Bang. How would that happen? Well, in his mind, the satanic star was going to collide with the Star of David and create the Big Bang, and that would be the end of everything, because Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the ending. We started with the Big Bang, we end with the Big Bang. Do you want me to talk about the book, the little book?
Sure.
Okay. Well, somebody, you know, some people might want to cover their ears, but he read the piece about the little book, you know, eat of the little book, which will be bitter in the belly, and he decided that meant he needed to eat his semen in order to discover the tree of knowledge and see God. So the tree of knowledge to him meant eating his semen, and in women it meant consuming their menstrual blood. And this played out in a very bizarre way in his whole scenario. So there was that. And you know, Dan, I mean, when he was calling his family members and saying, you know, you need to eat your semen, you'd think that would be a major clue.
Yeah.
But it's easy to judge in retrospect, but when you have a situation where you've got a family where there's never been any mental illness, you don't know anything about mental illness, I would imagine it's kind of like having a beloved parent, begin to show signs of dementia, and you just don't want to admit it. You know, you want to make excuses and put it off as long as you can. But this fixation on consuming bodily fluids would cause him to do something. You know, one of the more bizarre features of this crime is described in the book, and you know, if you want me to tell it, I'll tell it. But it, you know, just and many of these things were so outlandish and so disgusting and so really kind of horrifying. It just boggles the mind that his parents didn't commit him.
Yes, tell our audience, they're not squeamish.
Okay, well, good. Good for them.
Yeah.
Well, he, you know, he had been consuming his semen on a regular basis, and of course, as he did that, he really felt like he was getting closer and closer to God. And so he called his sister, he called his sisters and told them that they needed to consume their menstrual blood. And then he got this idea that if they wouldn't do it voluntarily, he might be able to help them. So he went over to one of his sisters and, you know, told her that she needed to do that in order to understand what he was going through. And she basically said, you know, don't ever talk to me about that again. She went off to work. So he went and went into her bathroom and found a discarded menstrual pad and extracted as much blood as he could out of that, took it to the kitchen, put it in a blender along with some orange juice, a packet of chicken soup, and some pages from the Bible, whipped it up, and then waited for her to come home and made her drink it. Well, of course, you know, she didn't drink much of it, but she got a little bit of a sip of it, so he felt like, you know, he had done his job, and she, you know, she was going to be able to see God. And again, she didn't know what was in that concoction, but her husband did. And again, he was not committed.
Yes,
and
God.
I keep saying this, again, for the benefit of people who are out there, who have people in their lives who are exhibiting this bizarre behavior, you know, do something about it. You know, how far does it have to go? And that's a rhetorical question, but when you read the book, when you read A Voice Out of Nowhere, readers tell me this all the time, they're literally shouting into the air, why won't you do something? You know, basically to the parents. Why won't you do something? So denial, you know, denial was as much of an enemy in this situation as the mental illness.
So this, so continue from this point when he has the idea of consuming his own semen and his family's menstrual blood for women. So tell us, proceed with the story.
Okay. Well, he starts fixating on numbers. And it's complicated to go through the whole thing because it would just take too long. But he counts and he had a deceased brother who was born stillborn. But he counts him in his calculations of how he decides that his family, each member of his family, has to sit on one point of the Star of David in order to hold it in place when the satanic star comes to collide. So he starts adding it up, and they're missing a number. So he's just think he's puzzling it out, and he decides that one of his sisters must be pregnant. So he starts calling his sisters, and sure enough, one of them is pregnant. But she was so early on, they hadn't announced it. And that was another one of those sort of creepy, you know, him being able to foretell things. And so his older sister, who lived far away, was pregnant, and he, as he was getting closer to his complete break, he decides to go up there on a bus, and which is no small feat. I mean, you know, you're going to travel from Vancouver to the interior of British Columbia, which is a long, long bus ride, 9 hours, I think, maybe more, and surprise her, and he walks into her house. She's in bed, and I think it's 3 or 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. It's total darkness, and he's standing in her room, and scares her to death. That morning, he says he'll fix her an omelet, and at this point he had started to see a psychiatrist who had given him some antipsychotic medication, he ended up putting the antipsychotic medication in her omelet.
Wow.
He was never really sure why. He thought it had something to do with the unborn baby, and the unborn baby needed to be killed to go up to the star. And she took one bite. Was terrible, so she gave the omelet to the dog. The dog almost died. She ended up going to the hospital for 8 days and almost lost the baby. So at this point, you know, you could say he tried to kill his sister.
Right.
And they still didn't do anything.
Did the family, well, the family never even called the police, obviously.
Nope.
Yeah.
They did not call the police.
If the police weren't involved, then a psychiatrist would have to be involved, but if no one told the psychiatrist, or psychologist, pardon me, did the psychologist know about it, about the incident?
Yes, but he was more concerned that they had let Bruce go up there unsupervised. I'm not making that up.
But yet, did he have any specific instructions for the family once he was under the care? Well, he had Bruce under his care.
Well, to the psychiatrist's credit, when he first met Bruce, he did sign commitment papers, which were good for 30 days. And I think that was on December 16th. Yes, it was December 16th, I believe. And he signed commitment papers. And he said, I'm not telling you to put him away right now, but, you know, you may need this. And if that's the case, please use it. So
I see.
The doctor, on the first visit, he went to the home. He gave Bruce a long-acting shot. To calm him down and quell the psychotic symptoms, and then put him on oral medications, and then set up a schedule to come and see the doctor, which was followed sort of haphazardly. But as is the problem with many people who have schizophrenia, Bruce at this point didn't believe he was mentally ill, and he didn't take his medication regularly. So without the family, and the psychiatrist really did not counsel the family about, you know, supervising him when he takes his medicines, making sure that he's actually swallowing them, counting the pills, you know, all of the things that we do now, or we should be doing now, really didn't happen. And unfortunately, every time the doctor saw Bruce seemed, he did not seem that agitated, you know, and occasionally he was even fairly articulate and able to kind of explain himself. So the doctor really never saw him, other than the very first time when he signed the commitment papers, he never really saw him kind of florid, you know, he never saw him full blown. But that's
so in your...
still doesn't excuse the inadequate treatment.
It would seem normal. It would seem, from my experience anyway, from what I've seen, is that he would have been hospitalized for at least the minimum, and they would have done a review, and they would have administered medication based on that. I don't understand how he could be forced, you know, determined to have this illness, forced to have the medication, but yet not in a hospital setting, and then expect him to take the medication. I mean, that's why they would commit someone to at least those few days and then assess whether they could release this person or, you know, that seems to be normal.
Right, but the family didn't agree. They had the opportunity to have him committed on December 16th, and they chose not to. And quite frankly, that is what likely would have prevented the tragedy, because he would have been diagnosed. See, he was never diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic until after the murders. And the reason for that is because of the way the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Disease, defined mental schizophrenia at that time. And you had to have you had to have displayed the symptoms for a period of time. I believe back then it was 6 months. So he couldn't, the doctor was not able ethically to diagnose him as a paranoid schizophrenic. But if he had been committed, they would have discovered, you know, the severity of his illness. They would have been able to say, look, this is the course of treatment we have to take. This is how serious it can become. You know, you can't just let him go out into the world and bang around on, you know, bump into corners and fall down and make mistakes. This young man needs help, and he's going to need help for the rest of his life. It very likely, if that had happened, could have been the bump in trajectory that would have changed everything.
Now, I still need explanation in terms of this medication, but for our audience, even though he wasn't diagnosed as this paranoid schizophrenic by the psychiatrist, and as a result, what kind of medication was he given, or is there just an antipsychotic drug that is encompasses all illnesses and regardless of the severity, even, or the designation by a psychiatrist?
Well, he was actually given the medication appropriate for someone who is suffering from paranoid schizophrenia. It's just that Bruce would not take it on a regular basis. At one point he was taking it and things kind of normalized, and I think that lulled the family into a false sense of everything's going to be okay. But then his delusions began again, and he just stopped. Because the evidence in court was, the doctor would ask the family, because the family was calling the doctor fairly regularly saying, you know, he's going on again about the end of the world, and the doctor would say, is he taking his meds? And they would say, well, we can't be on him all the time. How do we know? So the likelihood is no, he wasn't taking his medicine.
Why was Bruce not taking his medicine? Did he have a reaction to it? What was his rationale for not taking it regularly?
Well, he of course didn't give evidence in court, but this is a common problem with people who have schizophrenia that's developed to the point where, you know, it's literally embedded in who they are. They don't believe they're sick, and some people with schizophrenia will even believe that the medication is poison, so they don't want to take it. There's also the other side of it where someone does know that they need to take the medicine, but the side effects are just so unpleasant that they decide they don't want to. There was a case a year and a half ago, I think, another one in North Vancouver where a young man, his name was Jordan Ramsey, knew he was mentally ill with paranoid schizophrenia but hated the side effects, so decided to go off them and take vitamins instead. And these vitamins are marketed on the Internet for people with mental illness. Within a very short period of time, he became completely psychotic and murdered his father and almost killed his mother because he believed that the people inhabiting his mother and father's bodies were aliens, and he had to kill those aliens in order to get his parents back. So, Jordan knew he was sick, but he just didn't want to take that medicine anymore because of the weight gain and the lethargic way it made him feel and so on.
Now let's get to the actual day in question and tell us about Bruce's behavior, what all happened, what does he finally have conjured up in his mind. Tell us about his plan. Go back and then tell us what actually happens that fateful day.
Okay. Well, as I mentioned, he had been working as a swamper on a garbage truck. But his father had applied on his behalf to Selkirk College in Nelson, British Columbia, which is in the interior, for a millwright course. And a millwright is somebody who works on large machinery. And to everyone's total amazement, Bruce got accepted. But it was a very last-minute thing. So he had, you know, I think like a day or 2 days to pack up, to quit his job, pack everything up, and moved to Selkirk to start his classes. And the father called the psychiatrist and told him this. And the psychiatrist said, you know, I don't think this is a very good idea. That the lack of structure and the new environment could cause Bruce to regress. I really don't think you should let him go. The family sent him off. And while Bruce was on the bus heading to Nelson, the voices were, he hadn't been taking his medicine, so the voices were just on him, you know, just all of them, all of the voices all at once. And onto the bus walks this woman named Mary. And Mary was sort of your classic hippie, you know, with the long skirt and the peasant shirt and the beads and high as a kite.
Right.
She sits right down next to Bruce and taps him on the side of the head, right on the temple, and says, did you hear about the bug in the star? And he looked at her, and that was it. He thought that she had some kind of message for him directly from God, and she began to talk about things like, you know, she had died 5 times, and you don't really, when you die, you don't really die, you know, you can keep coming back, and you don't really bleed when you die if you've got a higher purpose. And so she's putting all of these ideas into his head, and he's believing every word that she says. Well, he finally gets up to his dorm room, and when they hand him the key, when he checks in, they hand him the key, looks at the key, and he realizes he now has the key to saving the world. And what that meant was that he had to go back home and kill his family so that their spirits could ascend to heaven, take their points on the Star of David, and hold the star in place. And when he figured that out, when they put that key in his hands and he figured it out, he felt such relief. He felt such peace because he finally knew what he was supposed to do. And as hard as it is to believe, he never went about this task with any aggression or hatred. He actually did it out of love. So he spent the night in his dorm. He couldn't get a bus home that night. He spent the night in his dorm, got up the next morning, caught a plane ride home. Finally, it was hard for him to get a flight. Anyway, got a plane ride home, showed up at home, surprised and scared everybody. Bruce's father immediately calls the psychiatrist and tells him what has happened. Psychiatrist says, I want you to take him to Royal Columbian Hospital right now, which was 5 miles away. I'll call ahead. You can get him medicated in the emergency room, but that's what I want you to do, and then I want you to bring him in tomorrow. And the father unbelievably said, you know, it's already after 10, and the hospital's 5 miles away. I think I can handle this until tomorrow. So mom goes to bed. Young brother Ricky starts watching TV. Dad sits down to do a crossword puzzle. Bruce goes downstairs and loads a couple of rifles and hides them. And then he goes back upstairs and lays down on the couch in the TV room with his brother and starts listening to tape mix, you know, that he's made of music that he likes, predominantly The Who and The Rolling Stones. And he's getting up and sort of ranting and raving about the end of the world. His dad is trying to calm him down. Bruce goes outside, smokes a joint, eats some of it, gets himself calmed down. He comes back in, lays back down on the couch, hears Roger Daltrey of The Who singing a song, and then a Rolling Stones song that one of the lines was, "Do it, do it, do it now, do it, do it, do it now." And he took the headphones off, he got up, he went down, got a rifle, stood at the bottom of the stairs, and the voices were just screaming at him, "You've got to do it, you've got to do it now." And they kept saying to him, "The gateway is narrowing, the gateway is narrowing," meaning the world is going to blow up if you don't make it through this gateway. And he didn't want to do it. He just didn't want to kill his family. But then he remembered what Mary had told him, that you don't really die and you don't bleed. And so he ran up the stairs, pointed the gun at his father. His father saw him coming, tried to defend himself, and shot him, killed him. Brother came running up the stairs, turned the gun on him, killed him. Ran upstairs to where his mother was sleeping. She, of course, had no clue what was going on. All she heard was screaming and gunshots down below. She ran for her life into the bathroom. He shot her in the back. And then to make sure that she was dead, went shot her point blank in the head once she was down. Then he went downstairs and phoned his sister, told her to come and bring his other sister, but to leave his brother-in-law at home. So they were in North Vancouver. They make the 30-minute drive. Oh, and they call the psychiatrist and say, we want Bruce committed. It's 4 o'clock in the morning, or 4:55 or something. It's really, you know, dark, dark. We want him committed. The commitment paper had expired 2 days before. So the psychiatrist says to the sister, "Don't go over there. Call the police." She said, "No, we don't want to upset our father. We're going over there." So the two sisters and the brother-in-law come over. Meanwhile, Bruce is listening to the voices telling him to clean up the blood. He moves some of the bodies around. He's cleaning up the blood. He's cleaning up the blood. And then they arrive, and he massacres them. And there were eyewitnesses to this, believe it or not, at that early in the morning. But he believed at some point during this whole thing that his brother-in-law, who was a big guy, 6'2" or 6'3" and 230 pounds, Bruce, on the other hand, is like 5'5" and 120. The brother-in-law isn't able to overpower Bruce. Bruce shoots him 6 or 7 times in the leg, in the face, and this big guy, sweetheart of a guy, won't die. So Bruce decides that his brother-in-law is the devil, and that the devil is trying to keep Bruce from saving the world. So Bruce goes and gets a hammer and bludgeons his brother-in-law unmercifully. When they found this poor man, his features were just indecipherable. And once Bruce had killed everyone, or thought he had killed everyone, he had a leather headband around his head. He looked at himself in the mirror, kind of adjusted that headband, decided that was his crown of thorns, and walked out into the night.
Now, how do police get to the find the bodies? How does that all happen? And tell us, where does Bruce go?
there were several, probably five either eye or ear witnesses. Nobody really was exactly sure what they saw because it was so dark.
Right.
But the one neighbor, his name's William in my book, he saw the shots fired. And he heard them, actually. He heard them. Of course, they sound like 22s sound like firecrackers. He hesitated at first, but then he called the police. And the police were very close by. I think it took them maybe 3 to 5 minutes to get there. And when they arrived, they found a young man who turned out to be Bruce, sort of wandering aimlessly on the street. They had no idea. They had no idea that what was waiting for them in the house and that this young man had committed the murder. So they left him, they left Bruce, with a rookie cop who was on the force for less than a year. And three police officers made their way to the house and, went inside, discovered the bodies. They discovered that the brother-in-law, who'd been bludgeoned, was still, incredibly, he was alive and struggling for breath. They called an ambulance. Meanwhile, the rookie RCMP officer is questioning the young man, and he blurts out that he's the Antichrist and the world is going to end at midnight. He radios that to the police officers who are walking around outside the house, and they go in and make their grisly discovery. But the rookie officer is talking to Bruce, and Bruce admits that he has killed his family. He's arrested for murder. He's taken to the detachment. And then that's where I got involved. Bruce came into my courtroom the next day for his first appearance, where he was sent away on a psychiatric remand. And that's how his life and my life collided.
Now, when police found him, was there any evidence like blood spatter on his clothing? Was there any indication that of the carnage that he had just created?
The arresting officer wrote in his notes that he noticed dark splotches on Bruce's shirt. Now, it was raining, and it was extremely dark. I don't have any evidence that he shone a flashlight on him. You would think that he would have testified to that in court. So he said he noticed dark splotches on his shirt and that and dark markings on his hands, and that the young man was shaking violently and appeared as though he wanted to cry. So they knew that there was something up, but really until they got him to the detachment and examined him and had him turn his clothes over, et cetera, they weren't able to confirm that it was blood. Plus,
now
I have to tell you this. The other thing is, if you saw this man, this young man, Bruce, and you saw what happened in that house, you could not put two and two together. You could not believe that such a small and mild-mannered person could do what happened in that house.
How small was he? What is the size, and what's his relative size?
Well, I think 5'5", 5'4", maybe 120, if 120 pounds.
And what does he look like in terms of, 22 years old, but what does he look like in terms of boyish?
He was actually very handsome, young man, looked kind of native. He looked like he had some native blood in him. So, he had a long bridged nose. He had beautiful, really beautiful black, straight, shiny hair, very elegant bone structure, which he inherited from his mother. He also inherited her petiteness because his dad was a big guy. Really good-looking young man. I mean, just such a sad thing. But you know, not menacing at all. In fact, the doctor who, the GP who came in and examined him that night in the jail, said, you know, he wasn't threatening at all. He was a small fellow, not threatening at all. And to me, and I remember, you know, sitting through the trial, just looking at him and thinking how powerful his psychosis must have been to literally give him a kind of demonic strength that he did not have.
Right. Now, how do they proceed with him in terms of, again, he is locked in a psychiatric facility. In terms of him coming to terms with what he has done, how long does it take for him to recognize or have a break from the psychotic break that he actually had?
Well, you know, they're very protective of that information because it's patient confidentiality, but he did not come to trial until he had stabilized, and so he started receiving medication in February of 1983, and his trial was scheduled for November. So it took, you know, quite a few months for him to stabilize. And although they didn't really talk about remorse or anything specifically, they did talk about him being on special attention, which is basically suicide watch, when the reality of what he had done began to sink in.
Right.
And the psychiatrist gave testimony that, you know, he moved from being very florid in his psychosis to being moderate and to questioning whether or not his delusions were real, to, you know, and this is all in the course of medication, you know, to suddenly realizing the, you know, the catastrophic nature of his actions, and then just becoming really, really depressed. Because the other thing also was that his surviving twin brother and sister, the one who he had put the had made the omelet for, they were afraid for their lives because he said that he maintained the whole time that the whole family needed to die in order to keep the world from blowing up, and that he needed to finish the job, and if he couldn't do it himself, they needed to commit suicide. And so they were afraid. So he had killed most of his family, and the two remaining family members wanted nothing to do with him. So when he finally moved to the other side of his psychosis, in other words, he moved to sanity, away from insanity, he had nothing, you know. He had nothing but the people in the mental hospital. Because, you know, the other reality was that the rest of the world, certainly all of Canada and anybody else paying attention elsewhere, thought he was a monster. You know, they looked at him like a devil, and so he knew he had no one on the outside to be caring about him or thinking about him, and that he had brought that on himself. So the psychiatrist, you know, mentioned very briefly those kinds of things, but of course did not get into any sort of details.
Now, if they've listened to the show regularly, I've pointed out that there are major differences in the way our courts, even though they're based on the same system, most glaringly from the U.S. and Canada, those comparisons. Now, in terms of, you say that everybody in Canada, the U.S. and internationally, you know, a man slaughters his family, is considered a monster, but the Canadian courts look at things quite a bit differently than the American courts and American prosecutors. And so Canada believes it's more evolved in this regard, and that is a point to, I guess, debate to a certain degree, but regardless, there is a difference. So tell us about in 1983, what the prosecution, how that worked, and how the courts were dealing with this particular case.
Well, the interesting thing that probably most people don't know is that back in 1983, the law was such that if you were found not guilty by reason of insanity, you would be sent to a secure forensic facility, Riverview Hospital, you know, any other mental hospital. And this is the language of the law, quote, until the pleasure of the lieutenant governor is known, unquote. And the big joke was, what, Canada has a lieutenant governor? You know, nobody knew who he was or she or whether there was even anybody in that post. So basically, if you were sent away on a not guilty by reason of insanity charge, you were going to stay there forever. But here's what happened. In the and I'll talk about, remind me to talk about prosecution when I'm done with this. In the United States, in the 50s and 60s, the American Civil Liberties Union started petitioning for people to have the right to be mentally ill. And the mentally ill had the right to refuse treatment. That led to this movement called deinstitutionalization, which basically meant closing down the mental hospitals and putting people who are mentally ill out into the community, replacing mental hospitals with community-based mental health care so that the mentally ill could exercise their free will and have lives like the rest of us and be supported by effective mental health care in their, you know, in the place where they live. It was a beautiful idea. It was grand and noble. But it was an epic fail because there was no infrastructure created. And, in fact, the money that was saved by closing the mental hospitals, and this should surprise no one, was not funneled into the new scheme. So Canada decided to follow the United States lead in the 80s. And so when Bruce went into Riverview Mental Hospital, Canada was already underway looking at the idea of deinstitutionalization. And shortly after he was committed, what we all thought for life, deinstitutionalization began. In fact, it was beginning at Riverview. So I'm going to tell you the last part of that story, but go back to the question about how the prosecution handles cases.
Right.
I think in Canada, it can be very, very different. And in Bruce's case, certainly, both the Crown, that's the prosecution, and the defense, both agreed that Bruce was mentally ill at the time he committed the crime. So it was not an adversarial trial. It was more an informational trial so that the public could be assured that, you know, enough evidence had been presented that, you know, that would prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that Bruce was mentally ill when he committed the crime. Here in the United States, you rarely see that. You know, when James Holmes comes back into court, that's the Aurora movie theater shooter, you know, they're going for the death penalty. There's no question
in
my mind that James Holmes was mentally ill.
Mm-hmm.
But there's going to be no agreement between prosecution and defense on that. You know, they're going for the death penalty. So that's one huge difference. And, you know, again, yes, it's debatable. Is it more evolved? Is it more humane? Is it that Canada's being too wishy-washy? It doesn't really matter. I mean, it is what it is. But that is a huge difference between the two countries, for sure.
Well, you know, the difference is, and I've spoken to a lot of true crime authors and authors and people in general in the U.S., and that is what the judicial system and the public is afraid of, is that someone deemed not criminally responsible because they're insane over something like this or taking of life, period, and that that person someday would be released. And that is what I'm trying to convey to our American and international audience. Canadians believe in that. And that's the, when I talk about an evolution, there's been an evolution of thought in terms of Canadians believe, well, of course, the person's not going to spend the rest of their life in jail because they didn't mean to kill anyone. And we've also evolved that we don't have a life sentence without the possibility of parole. So we do much more believe in rehabilitation, and we walk the walk in terms of actually letting people out. So in America, they are actually so afraid that someone would be deemed insane that they might get out someday from an institution that prosecutors and the public even shy away from the most obvious cases of obvious insane perpetrators.
Right. But you know what just makes me shake my head in bewilderment is that, yes, we're all afraid that a Bruce Blackman or a James Holmes will get out again, even after they're stabilized, because we see what they're capable of. We see what can happen if they don't take their medication and if they're not getting mental health care. So rather than live in fear and rather than stick these poor people who never asked to have a mental illness away in jail or a mental hospital for the rest of their lives, and this is a rhetorical question, but why can't we get a mental health care system that's community-based, that works, and that's proactive, and that spares no expense, keeping people like Bruce and like James stable and safe and supported, because their safety directly translates to ours. You know, we just keep focusing on all the wrong things. Yes, we know they're going to be released, so let's make sure we have a system in place that makes that an okay eventuality.
Here's the thing that I want.
You can tell I'm Canadian, right?
Yeah, well, here's the thing. I'm Canadian too, but this is where I differ from vast majority of people, and I don't buy into this, because we have an example, an extreme example here is a gentleman named Vincent Lee, the Greyhound bus beheader cannibal killer.
Yes.
Now, this person is in a hospital and now is receiving this extraordinary care, where they believe he's responding to the antipsychotic medication so well that he has now, within 3 years, been granted unsupervised visits into the community of Selkirk. At first, he was given extraordinary freedom from the community, from the institution itself, because it didn't have a fence around it confining the institution, yet he was out for walks and recreation. To me, is just extraordinary. And then what I look at is that they have an eventual plan of letting this person, this killer, out, despite the public, despite the victims' mothers pleading to have this person spend the rest of his life incarcerated in an institution. That this, there is sort of a battle going on to prove that the Canadian psychiatric industry can cure almost anyone via these, again, I hate to say this, but miracle drugs, rendering this former killer or mass murderers, or but in this particular case, Vincent Lee, to be harmless for the rest of his life. And then people say, well, how do you know he's going to take his medication? And we have talked about people who won't take their medication for various reasons. But my question is, how do we know this medication can render everyone harmless? Or are we dabbling in this experiment based on our ideology that we have that we can fix anybody?
I think the latter. I think we are dabbling. And you know, beyond having an adequate and proactive mental health care system that actually works, I think we need to look at the law. And I think that, you know, if you commit murder while you're psychotic, yes, you weren't responsible because you were in a different realm. However, I don't think that the law should render you not guilty by reason of insanity or because of mental disorder. I think you are guilty, comma, but insane or mentally ill or whatever. And if you are ever let out, a condition of your freedom is that you will report monthly for your medication. And if you don't, you get locked up. And I don't think that's too much to ask. And the ACLU can, just suck on that. But I don't think that's too much to ask. I think this idea of keeping people in a secure facility where they have the structure and they have the medication and they have the support that they need to get well, and then, gradually releasing them into the community, and then suddenly saying, okay, you're done. You're off our radar screen. You've done great. Go on. Now, go have your life. That, to me, is insanity. Because the reason that they're able to go out into the world now is because they've had all of that support. That you cannot change a brain disorder. You can't get rid of it. It's always going to be there. So the quote, miracle cure is all of the medication and all of the support and all of the psychotherapy and everything else that this person has gotten, which once they are fully released, goes away. So the miracle drug goes away.
The other thing that I think is valid as well is that, and we can discuss this, is that the vast majority, like I would feel sorry for anyone that says, walks into a party, walks into a job and says, oh, by the way, I'm schizophrenic. Based on Vincent Lee and all of the cases where a schizophrenic is the headline, where a schizophrenic killer, I believe that it just happens to be a killer who happens to be schizophrenic. Because you still have to have the ability to kill. And most schizophrenic don't have the ability to hurt anyone. And don't. And so they're not, as a statistic, aggression and violence is not a trait, a character trait. So when we say a schizophrenic killer, but that person still had the capacity to kill, and maybe we should look at those that have the capacity to kill. And again, in Canada, I'm totally disgusted with I'm drunk and I can't remember, or I'm drunk diminishes the role, diminishes murder to a manslaughter, and we're not talking first-degree manslaughter, we're talking slap-on-the-wrist manslaughter in Canada. Mm-hmm. That's another issue. But I think that we should look at that because the name schizophrenia already comes with enough of a label and a stigma that that it's not going to do much good. A guy like Vincent Lee in the headline for 2 or 3 years or in the paper is schizophrenic killer. So what do you think about the idea that schizophrenics are not known to be violent? Maybe we should just look at the idea that who has the capacity to kill and make sure those people remain in prison for the rest of their life or in some institution, we'll say.
Well, the challenge with that is how do you determine who has the capacity to kill? And Bruce, for example, was extremely gentle and mild-mannered. He had no history of violence, no tendencies towards aggression at all. So there were no clues. And really, I think, we have this problem with hearing the word schizophrenic or schizophrenia and immediately thinking violence. And you're right. The majority of people who have schizophrenia are not a danger to others. They're more of a danger to themselves because, the suicide rate amongst people with schizophrenia is really high. But it's the severely mentally ill, untreated individuals that we have to worry about, and not just people with schizophrenia, but people with severe bipolar or a combination of the two, even people with severe depression. But again, what I want to underscore is severe untreated. And
right.
And when allowed to progress, as Bruce's was, and who knows what, you know, if Mr. Lee showed any signs, but when they're allowed to progress with no, either no intervention or inadequate intervention, if you look at the statistics that have been revealed in the United States, there's been an alarming increase of mass murders committed by people with severe untreated mental illness since deinstitutionalization happened. And the Windsor Star did a really interesting article a few years ago. The same trend is happening in Canada. So, I think, again, I go back to this idea of having, if we're not going to have mental hospitals, we need to have community-based mental health care that works and that's easy, right? That's easy for families to get help for their family members. Because that's the other thing. There's so much paperwork. There's so many hoops to jump through. It's, it's just so hard to get the help that's needed when often that help is needed now, like right now. And we don't have that. We really need to work towards that. But I think the whole system is messed up and that we can do better. I mean, we're supposed to be an evolved, you know, North America, excluding Mexico, I don't mean anybody any offense by that, but, you know, Canada and the U.S. just think they're capable of solving any problem. And I believe we are, but we're just not focusing the correct energy and intelligence on this huge problem.
Yes, I think that we don't, again, we thought we should let these people out of institutions and then treat them in community centers, but we didn't do that. We just basically saved some money, and these people are wandering around, and you see them at the soup kitchens, you know, they're wandering around the streets all day. So that's their, you know, they had treatment, now they don't have treatment, so... And I agree with you that this is, you can see the trend in the U.S., this mental illness, people taking out their entire family based on depression, again, schizophrenia or some other, you know, mental illness where they're deluded and hallucinating, and we have things like, the Aurora movie shooting. So, I agree with you that it's, I've had programs where those stats are rising and more alarming, and again, bigger and worse incidents always, because that's always the way that it's going to be. So bigger and worse and more of, and so and with no end in sight. So I agree with you that we have to, for our own good, for all the potential victims, everyone being a victim involved in this story, and not wait for the police to have to do, basic. Psychiatric counseling or anything like that. You can't rely on the police to do anything like that. They have their job, and that is very little training in that respect. And so we do have to have trained professionals to intervene before they become to the police's attention, because that can go off the rails quite easily.
Absolutely.
I agree with you
there.
And
in fact, after my book came out, I got a letter from a police officer in New Westminster, which is another bedroom community of Vancouver, and she knew one of the victims in this book, and she wanted to tell me that at least 50%, that's 50% of the calls that the New Westminster Police Department is having to deal with have mental illness at the root. 50%.
Yeah. And they're seeing that in the institutions, too. There's far more people medicated in the institutions. It seems like, you know, the makeup of the prison population, again, is reflected in the rising mental illness that's through our society, so basically.
Right. Right. Well, there's got to be No, I was just going to say there's got to be somebody out there who wants to take on this great leadership challenge, because I really think this is one of the biggest moral crises of our century, and there's got to be somebody out there who's willing to spearhead the the change?
Well, you know, I think that it's cause for alarm, the amazing amount of cases that are not plea bargained in the U.S. when there is an obvious insane perpetrator because of a different system in terms of, electing judges and zealous prosecutors trying to make a name for themselves election time, and just the sentiment of the public that's sort of fed up, and it's easy to be portrayed as soft on crime on something like that. And the media is quite a bit of a different animal in the U.S. as compared to Canada. We kind of shy away from a lot of the details, as evidenced by the Picton trial and by the Bernardo and Amalca trial. When you really ask your average Canadian about those, they didn't really focus on them. What I wanted to mention, just because I think you misconstrued what I meant, and it was probably my fault, when I said about the capacity to murder, I do not mean that there is any kind of magic bullet to predict people's violent behavior in the future. What I'm saying is that when you have the capacity to kill and dismember and cannibalize a victim, I think you have the capacity to kill. And I think that Vincent Lee, I apologize to maybe Vincent Lee, but I don't think he should ever be released from a psychiatric institution. And inversely, I think in the U.S. that many more cases should be, the perpetrator should be deemed insane. And then as a humane gesture, they should be, and whether they can afford it or not, they can afford murder trials and all the subsequent appeals, they can afford to put those perpetrators in a psychiatric institution, regardless of people's fears that they might someday be released. I'm pretty sure that that won't be allowable for the most part anyway.
Right, right. Well, the way the law is, the law has got to change in both places. And I don't know who's willing to tackle that, but because you've still got the ACLU saying people have a right to be mentally ill and they have a right to refuse treatment. But my counter to that is, all those children who died at Sandy Hook had a right to expect that they could grow up and lead meaningful lives. So why does one person's rights outweigh the rights of all these other people? I don't get it.
The thing is that if a person has displayed violent behavior to the point that they're incarcerated, then that's the end of that. Then they're incarcerated. If that person is released, because of the law, we have that with, psychopathic killers, which is not a mental illness, but those people that totally cannot be rehabilitated and they reoffend, but someone in this particular case that is not criminally responsible because of insanity, once they've demonstrated that they are dangerous, then the onus is on them to, and not the public. It's not a reverse. They have to, like you say, a monitoring, whatever it seems reasonable by the public to ensure that this person would not be harmful in the community is what they need to do. Once they have shown the capacity to kill, however, I think the judicial system should take care of that and ensure that that doesn't happen again.
I agree with you. I think once you do that, once you cross that line, mental illness or no mental illness, life for you is never going to be the same.
Now, just to sort of wrap up here, what was the fate of this Bruce gentleman? Now we're talking about 1983. To your knowledge, what happened to him?
He spent 12 years in the institution. He was given, and remember, deinstitutionalization is beginning to happen in Canada at this point.
Right.
So, in preparation to see if he was going to be able to be released, they started giving him supervised passes or supervised visits outside of the asylum, and then he was given unsupervised day passes. He had to return to the institution every night. And that worked out well because, of course, he would come back and he would get his medicine and he would talk to the nurse and there were no problems. And then And then when the law changed where a person could no longer be held indefinitely by virtue of whether the lieutenant governor made an order or not, once that law changed, they pretty much had to release him. And doctors testified on his behalf. There was a public outcry. People did not want him released. But the government, helped him change his name and then released him quietly into the community. And he has never granted an interview. He's living under an assumed name. Nobody is exactly sure where he is. And he's pretty much stayed way under the radar. But he's living amongst us now.
Right. And if he would have reoffended, journalists with the means that they have would have known. So as far as we know, there's been no reoccurrence, obviously.
Thankfully, yes.
There's not much family left, so.
I know.
Yeah. That's a bad joke, sorry. But anyway, I want to thank you very much for this. Is there any way people can contact you? I know you do Facebook. Do you have a website? So maybe people are compelled to contact you further after this interview?
Yes. Yes, and I would love that. I'm at janicehollybooth.com. And if they can't remember that, then just Google A Voice Out of Nowhere, and it'll pop up. But I would love to hear from folks, on any aspect of what we've talked about. This is a topic of great concern to me, as it is for many, many people. And there will be a sequel coming out. I don't know when, because the first one took me 30 years to write, and but there is
quicker
more to say
time
on this story. Yeah, a little quicker.
A little quicker this time, yeah. Well, I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about A Voice Out of Nowhere. It's a fascinating book and equally fascinating interview speaking with you, and I got to vent a little bit about Canada's system too, so I got to thank you for that too. So you're very kind. So thank you very much, Janice Holly Booth, for coming on and talking about A Voice Out of Nowhere.
Thank you, Dan. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Have a good night.
You too.